Our second case for this morning is related to the first case, but in a somewhat different posture. United States against Samuel Volpendesto, or whatever is left of Samuel Volpendesto.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is Blair Westover, and I represent the defendant appellant, Mr. Sam Volpendesto, in this case. And I guess I'd like to start out with that sentence, because it seems to be a source of disagreement between the government and the defense. The government
perhaps you can say, at the Court's request, and we appreciate that, the interests of Samuel Volpendesto, whatever form they may be taking at this point, which is certainly a question for us.
Yeah, that's a fair enough statement. The government's argument, as I understand it, the government's first argument is that this Court lacks all jurisdiction, as a matter of, like, Article 3 of the United States Constitution, lacks jurisdiction to do anything other than dismiss Mr. Volpendesto's appeal. That is, this Court has no authority to order that the district court vacate Mr. Volpendesto's conviction. I think in making that argument, the government is essentially saying that the doctrine – I think what they're really saying is that the practice of vacating a defendant's conviction is just misplaced from the beginning. The entire doctrine
is wrong. It's a very ambitious argument, since it challenges decades upon decades, if not centuries, of history of abatement of criminal convictions upon the death of the person. I'm thinking of Ken Lay in the Enron case in recent years and so on. And it seems that if there really is that deep an Article III problem, then everything, then there could be nothing that lasts. And if there isn't a big Article III problem, then we would have the issue whether restitution is somehow different from a sentence for a term of years, obviously, which abates upon death, or criminal forfeiture.
Right. The only point that I wanted to make about the jurisdiction in lieu of any other questions that I don't think came out in our reply brief is that the U.S. government relies heavily on U.S. versus Bancroft, but I think that Bancroft doesn't do...
Bancroft is a civil case.
Right, and more importantly, in that case, the Supreme Court was asked, maybe you don't have Article III standing to vacate. The Supreme Court rejected that. They said, no. We have Article III standing at least to vacate if we wanted to. We're just choosing not to do so here.
And they set forth standards in Bancorp. They say vacation isn't the usual thing to do, although there are some circumstances, even after Bancorp, in which it's the appropriate thing to do.
Right, and I would point out that Bancorp was specifically talking about situations where the reason for the case becoming moot was sort of done on purpose by one of the parties. And whatever we want to say, I don't think that Mr. Volpendesto can be held accountable for his own death in that way. I think that in that case, in fact, in Bancroft, the Supreme Court specifically stated that in civil cases where it is not the fault of either party, vacating the conviction remains mandatory, or the underlying judgment becomes mandatory, and it's still mandatory in cases where it's nobody's fault. So if we're going to straightforwardly apply Bancroft, even though it's a civil case, to Mr. Volpendesto's situation, I think then the conviction would still vacate. So unless there are any questions about jurisdiction itself, I'd like to spend some of...
I'd be interested in your views on the split in the circuits on the question whether restitution orders abate along with the rest of the conviction. Let's just assume for the sake of discussion right now that the underlying criminal conviction abates.
Assuming that the underlying criminal conviction abates, I think the main thrust of our argument is sort of, and I think it's difficult to explain how this would work, the analytical difficulty of understanding how a restitution order would actually remain in effect after the indictment itself from the very beginning is said to no longer exist. And as pointed out by some of the court's sister circuits, the language of the MVRA seems to suggest that when sentencing a defendant convicted of an offense described in the subsection, the court shall order restitution. That suggests that the conviction is sort of necessary to maintain the restitution order. So, for example, if Mr. Volpendesto had been successful in his appeal and his conviction had been overturned by this court, we wouldn't expect the restitution order to stay in effect. Now, the government points out, well, this is a different situation because this court, in vacating Mr. Volpendesto's conviction, would not be saying that there was some sort of constitutional or trial infirmity, with it. But I guess I would point out the statute doesn't make that distinction, and I'm not sure where the basis for saying we're coming up with that distinction comes from, in that, again, if the indictment is gone, it's kind of hard to see how the restitutionary stands.
That begs the question, too, about what precisely the argument is here, whether the jurisdictional argument and how it relates to the merits argument, the substantive argument here. And as I understand it, the argument is that the doctrinal underpinnings for the abatement rule, if you trace it back far enough, relate to the principle that the government can't punish a dead person.
Right.
And so the punishment, the idea is that the punishment abates, the sentence abates, and this idea that the conviction is void ab initio and also abates is flawed. And that's the whole argument that the government is making about the Dove case overruling the Durham case. And the Supreme Court said very little in Dove in announcing the overruling of Durham, but I think one reasonable understanding of that, not the one that our circuit has adopted, which gets to the correctness of the Mollenkamp decision, but one interpretation of Dove is that this whole idea about the conviction abating, the entire judgment being void ab initio, is erroneous, and that that is not what the abatement principle really is about. The abatement principle is about abating the punishment because you can't punish a dead person.
Right.
And that's where we get to this distinction between the components of the judgment that relate to punishment and the components of the judgment that relate to compensation that are non-punitive in nature. And I think, you know, to get at that analytically, we have to understand what the abatement principle is all about and get it back to its original underpinnings.
Sure, and I understand that. I think among the circuits, though, there are two principles at work here, right? There's
the finality principle just doesn't work here because there is no real basis for it. And I know that you're making the two arguments, and the cases make two arguments for abatement of the entire judgment, restitution included. But this finality rule, it just isn't viable. The conviction is final when the judgment is entered. Because there is a right to appeal doesn't make it non-final, except with respect to collateral attack, and that's a legal construct.
Right.
But there's nothing non-final about the judgment once the sentence is imposed and implemented.
Sure, and I understand that. I think that when the term finality might be kind of an unfortunate term, what they're really saying is it's basically unfair.
Well, and they're saying
it's
more of a process point. It's certainly a final judgment, but in a system where a right to appeal is afforded, and a right to appeal that is so highly respected that the Sixth Amendment right to counsel attaches to that right to appeal. This is not like collateral attacks where you have no right to counsel. There is a strong tradition, at least, that that means until that right has been exercised, the final judgment is subject to being set aside under the ordinary rules that apply to them, not under the extraordinary circumstances for collateral attacks. So finality may be a mischosen word here, but the idea that there is a process protected by the Sixth Amendment itself once there is an appeal is an important one. And I'm not sure where you would put forfeiture in the middle of all of this, but I'll just throw in that anything that's subject to forfeiture is not available for the payment of restitution. Forfeiture is a procedure by which the United States obtains title to the goods, subject to, of course, somebody finding out about it and proving superior title. But it doesn't affect the defendant's restitutionary obligation. It's an animal of its own. It's a civil-ish remedy tucked into a criminal case where you don't have the usual protections of a civil judgment.
Sure, I would say this court's case law found that forfeiture certainly abates just as a matter of in Zizzo, this court has held that fines and forfeiture abate. And I understand what you're saying, that restitution is different because it does have penal and largely penal purposes. I think there's, you know, for some purposes it is considered compensatory.
No, it affects all kinds of rights in the victim.
Right, it does. And I understand
so
that.
So it's obviously compensatory. But we've said that.
The court has all, the Supreme Court and other courts have also said that it is, in part at least, punitive. I mean, for the purposes of whether or not discharge is a bankruptcy, it's part of the punishment. It's dependent upon the crime. And I'm out of time.
It's not personal.
Can you answer the judge's question,
it's,
please?
It's not, but it's not personal to the defendant in the sense that a prison sentence or a fine is. And that's why I'm trying to relate it back to the original purpose of the abatement doctrine and get away from this finality principle, which I think is confusing and not doctrinally sound. It's a common law rule that's, as Chief Judge Wood has pointed out, justice-based. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to get you to make an argument from that standpoint.
Well, like I said, I think that the finality principle, as it's termed, is justice-based. It does have to do with, should we hold somebody accountable after their conviction has been vacated if they haven't had the right of direct appeal? And Mr. Volpendo's estate could be burdened based on a conviction that doesn't exist and that hasn't been tested on appeal.
Well, and that's the point. If there's anything in his estate left over after the government's forfeiture of the $1.8 million worth of whatever they found, then Mr. Volpendesto's estate will be there, which shows that they're certainly standing. But mm-hmm. anyway.
Ms. Westover, if the conviction is abated,
mm-hmm.
I'm presuming jurisdiction here. Conviction's abated. What about, could we permit the estate to proceed with the appeal on the restitution?
That's an interesting question. I've sort of grappled. The Third Circuit does that.
Mm-hmm.
I think there would be a case in controversy. I don't see a jurisdictional problem with it off the top of my head, to be honest with you.
But is there a problem with no one being able to defend the interests of the estate?
That would be an incredible problem. Just in terms of fairness at that point, because, you know, the state is going to be locked in to a conviction that hasn't been tested, at least on appeal, in that circumstance. So unless there are any other questions, thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Bacciu.
May it please the Court. In response to, I think I'll just start obviously with the jurisdictional issue, one thing I'd like to point out to the Court is the writing, the opinion from the Court in the Molenkamp case. In deciding that it should vacate that conviction, what this court wrote was, we see no reason why the rule of vacator, that is the court is referring to, should be any different in a criminal case than it is in a civil case.
Well, the point is, well, first of all, you've over-argued Bancorp significantly because it does not say, as a matter of law across the board, there is never vacator. What it says is it shouldn't be the default rule. The courts of appeals have been wrong to think that it is in these settlement situations. There are some situations that remain where vacator is possible on the civil side. Secondly, on the criminal side, I think whatever offhand remark was made in Molenkamp equating civil and criminal is not something that was done with full briefing, with full attention on that. It's not at all clear to me that a civil judgment and a criminal conviction are the same thing.
Well, I would respectfully disagree that we've over-argued Bancorp. What Bancorp says is that the Court of Appeal is not permitted to vacate the judgment of a district court based upon some assumption as to the validity of the judgment.
It says, among other things, it may say that, but it says it in the context of looking at parties who have settled, who are trying to erase what the district court did as part of their settlement. The Supreme Court is protecting the civil adjudication process for that. You don't have to agree with me at all, but I personally think that that you are taking Bancorp well beyond its context and what the Supreme Court was writing about.
Well, Judge,
I also think that if what the government is aiming to do in this case is to erase
the entire notion that criminal convictions abate upon the death of the criminal, I see no hint in the Supreme Court's decisions that that's where the court thinks we should go. This would be a seismic move, and I think one that leaves people such as the estate of Mr. Volpendesto, but not limited to that, unable to have their day in court. It means the government can go absolutely untested and seize, you know, forfeit whatever property it wants to forfeit, take money out of accounts that are successor accounts to the deceased person for whatever restitution with no due process whatsoever, which really bothers me.
That's correct at all, Judge.
Well, that's what you're arguing for. You're saying we get to keep all the money and there's no abatement.
That's not correct. We're not saying the abatement doctrine is wrong.
Yes, you are in your brief.
No, we are not. What we are saying, Judge, is that at this stage in this case, there is no party withstanding before this court to challenge the judgment of the
district
court.
There never will be when a defendant dies. You can't limit that.
Well, A, the point would be, first of all, the government would not likely try to enforce the penal aspects of a judgment against a third party.
I don't like arguments that say, trust us, we'll do the right thing.
Well, the other point,
it seems to me due process requires, let's just take forfeiture, which is a little less civil, if you will. Forfeiture is part of the criminal conviction. If there's no abatement, then the government can go around after the death of somebody and just take whatever it wants without any testing whatsoever as to whether it was proceeds of the crime, whether you've already taken enough for substitute proceeds.
I don't think that's correct at all, Judge. A party that would be subject to that type of proceeding would be able to come to the district court, file a motion, and say to the district court, Your Honor, we should not be enforcing this judgment due to the doctrine of abatement. And that's the point, exactly the point that the Kentucky Supreme Court made when it said, hey, look, we don't issue advisory opinions. We do not decide abstract issues.
And there's no advisory opinion here. There's an injury. There's some assets that were not let's hypothetically assume assets not subject to forfeiture that Mr. Volpendesta's estate still has. And you want them, so that's injury in fact. You're the ones who are going to take it. That's causation. You're going to inflict the injury, and the injury could be redressed by this court saying, no, the conviction means that all consequences of the criminal sentence abate.
I don't think that's correct at all. The issue is there injury in fact from a party that is before the court right now? Mr. Volpendesta was dead.
I know it. And under the federal rules of appellate procedure, when somebody dies, you can substitute their estate.
Well, Judge, that may be the case, but we have a couple of problems right now. First of all, there's nothing in the record to actually suggest there is an estate for Mr. Volpendesta. Second, there's nothing in the record to suggest the estate has an interest in intervening in this proceeding. Third, there's nothing to suggest that there actually would be a potential tangible loss to that estate.
Well, I understand that, and I'm just going to say that that is very typical in cases where somebody dies for a period of time. This court just issued an in-bank opinion in the Killian case where we went back and forth and back and forth, substituting the estate in, taking the estate back out, substituting the estate in, and this is something that can be handled without losing Article 3 authority.
Well, the Killian case does not apply. In the Killian case, you had a party before the court that actually alleged, A, that it was owed money that had already been taken from it, that it improperly paid money, and two, that it was still getting dunning letters from the medical providers that were asking for payment. That's clearly not what's going on in this case. What we have in this case is metaphysical injury. There's a dead person here, a dead person that cannot suffer any injury. And a dead person is asking this court.
You want to take the money from his estate anyway without anyone having the right to contest anything.
At this juncture, we are saying that there's no case and controversy before this court.
Well, what if 6 months later a cousin appears? Would you oppose standing?
Well, if that cousin appeared and we attempted, for example, to enforce the forfeiture order against the cousin.
No, restitution. Stick with restitution.
Yeah, restitution.
Well, with regards to restitution, that would be something that obviously we argue on the merits does not abate. And if we have somebody who would actually come to court, say, for example, a district court, and say, Judge, we don't think you should enforce the restitution order, then as a matter of law, the district court would be able to decide whether or not the restitution order abates. We wouldn't say.
How is that litigated? You can't get intervention in a criminal case.
Well, certainly if we applied to the district court for a turnover order as to assets in the possession, say, for example, of a cousin or a nominee, say we decided that there's some nominee out there who it was hiding assets for Sam Bulbendest, and obviously that's happened in other cases, that party would at least be able to raise the issue of whether or not, as a matter of law, a restitution order is part of the doctrine of abatement.
We don't dispute that. Once you seek enforcement by
right.
court order.
Right. But then you'd actually have a real case in controversy before the court at that point in time. We don't have that now, and I know we've been talking about jurisdiction for a while. I'd like to talk just briefly about the merits, if I might. With regards to this issue of the equities under Bancorp, and that, I think there is no dispute then that if we get to the merits, the type of analysis that the court in Bancorp suggests is the proper one.
So can I just say, there was a time when the government negotiated appeal waivers in criminal cases where there was a guilty plea, in which they obtained agreement on the part of the defendant not to challenge either the sentence or the conviction or on collateral attack. It is my recollection that at this point, appeal waivers also include restitution as part of the criminal judgment. So I point that out only to say that the legal structure that allows a restitution order is inside the criminal proceeding. And that's why I have trouble taking it out of the criminal proceeding. And I'm particularly bothered by this because it's very hard, actually, to think of instances in which the United States, unlike state attorneys general who bring parens patriae suits all the time, when the United States brings a lawsuit for the private recovery of particular individuals, that's a very unusual model for the United States.
Oh, well, Judge, it's a model that Congress has basically instructed.
No, they didn't. They put it in the criminal proceeding, and that's why. And so I'm resisting your trying to take it out of the criminal proceeding and put it off in some unique civil-ish area.
It is a part of the criminal proceeding, to be sure. But the purpose of restitution is not to compensate the government. It's to compensate the victims. And,
right.
and Congress
yeah,
was
fine.
Abundantly clear about that point.
And the purpose of the criminal conviction is in part protection of the victims. That's why victims have the right to speak in criminal cases. The criminal process is very much concerned with the rights of victims, not just their restitutionary rights.
Yes, and quite rightly so. And so I think if...
But you know, wouldn't say that means you don't have a reasonable doubt standard at the... At the guilt stage, because the victims have the right to speak up.
No, I wouldn't suggest that we didn't have a reasonable doubt burden at the district court stage. But just to answer the question, I think the point is that with regards to restitution, that merely because it's entered ancillary to the criminal conviction doesn't mean that somehow if the criminal conviction needs to be abated, which we submit it doesn't, that the restitution order can't stand in place. And other courts have, obviously, circuit courts and
split,
state courts
obviously.
Have let the restitution stand.
If the tradition is to abate the conviction, that's because of why? An unease that we haven't had the filter of review?
Judge, if I read the Mollenkamp opinion correctly, that's exactly why. And that's the problem
okay, so,
that I have with the bank.
Right. So maybe, for example, if it's not guilt or innocence on a sufficiency basis, it might be a technical error. We'll never know because that review doesn't take place. Can we be as comfortable that the basis for the abatement is not in need of review? I'm trying to use the same logic. Not trying to make a civil-criminal distinction so much as I am. If we have the unease... just because we haven't had the review opportunity on the criminal conviction, should we also have that unease about whether the basis, though it may very well be in this case, is sufficient on the to justify the abatement in the initial?
Right, and I think I may have misapprehended your question initially. I think that the proper basis for the abatement doctrine is to prevent punishment from occurring in the future. There are courts that have also expressed unease about the issue of not being able to review the conviction. And I think that.
I'll just say with that, I mean, I can remember not a small number of cases where one of the issues on review from a criminal conviction was the correctness of the restitution order. And I can remember reversing on that basis where, for example, the district court imposed a restitution order based on intended loss instead of actual loss, or whether the district court imposed a restitution order taking into account people other than direct victims of the crime. And so when that happens, the restitution order itself is the focus of the criminal appeal. The amount of money gets changed, reversals happen on that basis. So to say that you need to erase all possibility of testing the restitution order because the defendant died seems to me, again, an extreme position.
It's not an extreme position in the sense that the judgment really is personal to the defendant. The right to an appeal
doesn't matter if it's wrong. So if the judge says it's a $2 million restitution order based on intended loss when it really should have been 1.5, you say, oh, what the heck?
Well, there shouldn't. What I'm saying is there shouldn't be a presumption of invalidity. There should be a presumption of correctness because we had a process. We complied with the procedures in the Bill of Rights with regards to the trial proceedings. The Supreme Court has made clear there is no right to an appeal. And a lot of courts.
An appeal. If we abolished appeals tomorrow and we all went home and sat on the porch, you know, then you'd be fine.
Right, but the court in Bancorp made specifically clear that Bancorp was a case that was before the Supreme Court. After it had granted certiorari, the reversal rate for the circuit involved in Bancorp, the Ninth Circuit, is over 80%. I'm happy to report the Seventh Circuit is on the low end of the scale. But
that's the cert process. They don't grant cert in cases where it's obviously correct.
Right, but the point is if the Supreme Court is willing to say you should not vacate a conviction because there is some potential presumed invalidity in the lower court's judgment in a situation where the presumption of incorrectness is over 50%, we know the presumption of incorrectness for a criminal case is nowhere near 50%. We know, if you look at the statistics that are on the U.S. court's website for 2012, that the presumption of incorrectness, or the number of cases that were reversed on appeal and terminated, is 7%.
Has the Supreme Court ever said that that kind of statistical analysis dictates somebody's due process rights?
Well, what the Supreme Court has said, statistical analysis is something that suggests that if a case is before the Supreme Court, it's more likely to be incorrect, and that's not a proper basis.
They haven't said that that takes away your right to go to court, though.
But what they have said is you cannot decide to vacate a judgment on the presumption that because somebody has not had a right to an appeal, there's something wrong with the judgment below. Just if I could briefly argue, respond to Judge Flom's question, we do say that a punishment is the principle that underlies the doctrine. That's where it comes from. We're not saying that if another party comes before the court at some later point when we try to enforce the restitution order, that they would not have an opportunity to raise this issue of abatement as to restitution. The finality issue.
How do they intervene?
Well, Judge, usually what we would do is we'd probably file a motion under Rule of 38 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. 38E2 allows a district court judge, after an appeal is over, to enter any order reasonably necessary to enforce a restitution order. So what we would do is file a motion pursuant to Rule 38 or a turnover order or a garnishment order in the district court, and that would initiate a process where a party that was the subject of that order could legitimately come into court and say, we object to the order. We think the order should be quashed, amended, on the basis that under the doctrine of abatement, the restitution order is no longer valid. And then, in fact, we would actually have a party that has Article III standing. Right now, we have a metaphysical inquiry where there's a dead man that is telling this court.
It's not a medical physical injury. It is on one side and it's not on the other side. If you're correct and there's never any abatement, then that issue can be decided by the court. Yes abatement, no abatement.
In the abstract, it can be decided by the court.
Well, I mean, it makes a big difference because if we say there is abatement, then you're shut off. The government's position has changed.
Right, but we prevailed.
If we say there is abatement.
Prevailed below. So we do not have standing to challenge the judgment below. We prevailed. We're not asking this court to reverse the judgment below.
Mr. Alpendesta is saying there's abatement. I'm saying if we agree with him that there is abatement, your position has changed. You are no longer able to pursue restitution. So in that sense, option A, your position's changed. Option B, lots of things can happen in the future. But that's plenty for our ability to adjudicate.
My only point being, Judge, is that as this case is before this court, Article III standing requires a party before this court who asks for redressment, or redressing some injury. We're not asking this court to redress an injury. We won below. Mr. Volpendesto does not have a redressable injury. He is dead. He is not going to pay any money to anybody. He is not currently in prison. He is not serving a sentence. The attorney that represents him now has not consulted with him about whether or not this is the appropriate course of action that he wishes to take. How is this court to know that Mr. Volpendesto now wants this court to vacate his conviction and the restitution order? Mind you, he did actually file a brief in this court in which he did not challenge specifically the restitution order. So how is it that this court has jurisdiction? I don't think it does. But if it does, I think it's equally clear that Congress's priority was not the interests of a dead defendant and whether or not their reputation or their interest in having somebody out there potentially pay money was addressed. Congress's interest, when you look at 3551,
Congress is free to pass another statute that addresses the dead defendant problem. You know, issue is, what does the statute they did pass?
Right, and the statute they did pass says that victims' rights are to be aggressively pursued.
No, it doesn't. It says upon conviction, blah blah blah, there's restitution.
Well, the note to 3551.
Right, the statute.
The note to 3551 of the Criminal Code says the Attorney General is to enforce restitution orders to the fullest extent of the law. The Senate report, where it said that restitution is a concept.
I understand that. You put all of that in your brief. So,
if there are no further questions, I tender, like I said, I don't have any time to tender.
You don't. I sort of doubled your time, but that's all right. Anything further, Ms. Westover, since I did, in fact, give extensive extra time to Mr. Bhatiu?
The only additional point I would make is that I don't want us to get too far afield in what Bancorp says. I don't think that Bancorp can be read for the principle that we can no longer consider the finality or a defendant's, even a dead defendant's, interest in having his appeal conviction tested by appeal, that that's no longer important as an equitable consideration when a defendant dies, mooting out his case pending appeal. I don't think that Bancorp could be read that broadly. Because what Bancorp is saying, again, Bancorp said, applies to a limited situation where the fact that the case was mooted is based on a settlement agreement that was agreed to by both parties. It's something that both parties participated in. In that case, they specifically said, essentially, that when it's no one's fault that the case was mooted, when circumstances intervened, then in the civil context, vacating the district court is still mandatory. Both the parties in that case agreed with it. I think the quote from Bancorp is, both parties agree that, you know, if this was an unintended, just consequential decision, vacating the judgment would be mandatory. So I just don't want to get too far off afield on that. Like I said, I ran out of my rebuttal time before, so there are no questions.
Apparently not. Thank you very much. We appreciate your assistance to the court. Thanks to the government.